Welcome to the For the Church podcast, another great gospel-centered resource from Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary. My name is Jared Wilson. I'm an associate professor of pastoral ministry and author in residence at Midwestern Seminary. And I'm here as always with my friend and my colleague and my co-host, Dr. Ronnie Kurtz, assistant professor of systematic theology. Did you notice anything different about the intro this week?
I did.
What?
I had to think about it. Yeah. I noticed. That title.
Yeah.
Come on,
associate.
Man. Associate. Hey, congrats, dude.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
For real.
Yeah.
That's a big deal.
Moving on from the white belt to the associate. Get to say that now.
Yeah.
I was talking to my wife, a few weeks ago about this promotion move, what have you. Yeah. And I was like, assistant, associate, what difference does
it,
they sound,
it makes a difference.
They sound the same to me. And she goes, no, assistant sounds like you're assisting somebody. Associate sounds like, she goes, it sounds like you're your own person.
Wow.
And I'm like, yeah.
I cannot wait to be my own person.
I am my own person. So I don't know what happens then when you drop the associate. Like, how many years are you an associate?
Well, every school it's different. So ours is like, okay. We have like a set thing that has to happen. So.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because some of the guys, right? We had a couple of profs who I think moved
to full professorship.
To just professor.
Yep.
Dr. Schreiner, I think, did.
Yeah, Patrick did, and a few others. Yeah, they moved to full professorship. That's typically the next.
There's a benchmark. Full professorship.
Yeah.
So at this stage, we're still like...
We're working.
We're like fractions.
We're climbing the hill.
We're just... We're running up that hill.
Running up that hill.
All I could think about... this is before your time, maybe, but do you ever watch Seinfeld?
I've like watched hit or miss episodes.
Yeah, there's a scene where... they're asking Elaine, they're at the diner, and they say to Elaine's complaining about her job, and they're like, well, what exactly do you do there? And she goes, I am an associate. Costanza goes, hey, me too. And then the waitress who's filling their coffee goes, me too. So I thought, we're all associates now.
Yeah, look at that. You also got an endowed chair.
An endowed chair, yeah.
That's a big deal.
A lot of people keep asking me what that means. I'll be installed, or I will have been installed. I don't know what the timing is.
I mean, in a lot
there's some kind of ceremony, I think, that they're going to do with the Dighton family. It's the endowed chair, the Steve and Mary Dighton Endowed Chair of Pastoral Ministry.
How amazing, man.
Yeah.
I'm stoked
because the Dightons are awesome, and so it's great to be in a role that's named for them.
Yes.
If you're listening, not familiar, Steve Dighton is pastor emeritus of Lenexa Baptist Church in Lenexa, Kansas. Lenexa Baptist Church has been very kind and generous to the seminary over the years since Jason Allen.
Yeah, crucial.
Coming here 15 years ago, is that right? Yeah, a while ago. And so they have created this endowment for a position that devoted to pastoral ministry. And I found out a few weeks ago that they were holding this endowed chair position.
It's well deserved.
Just for me and my promotion and doctorate and everything.
So that's amazing.
I'm really stoked.
Yeah, congratulations. For a lot of people in the academic world, like reaching full professorship and then even endowed chair is kind of like the end goal.
Yeah.
So you've arrived, man.
Okay.
So congratulations.
There's nowhere else to go.
That's right.
Except
now you just get to enjoy it.
I'm going to a new office too. There's a lot of changes.
They're
going to move me to a new office. I get to be over there in the cloister with
Tommy Kidd, Don Whitney.
Jason DeRoshi and Tommy Kidd are all in this little. They're off to themselves.
That's a hive mind.
And I've always wondered, like, it's like we're all in the faculty hallway.
Yeah.
They're in what I would consider the ivory tower, even though they're on the bottom floor. It's in the library. It's on the first floor. But I'm like, that's the ivory tower.
That's the ivory tower.
And I'll never be over there. And now I get to go over there.
You're there. You're in the ivory tower, man.
Yeah.
They warned you about this.
I was over there with Brandon Freeman not too long ago, working through like what furniture we wanted and everything. It's fun.
That's awesome, man. Congratulations.
It's fun days.
All
thanks
well
much.
Deserved.
This chair, this endowed chair, it's an actual chair.
Yeah,
it's
an actual chair. Yeah, it's not for everyone. Like other places don't actually do some chairs, but here it's an endowed chair.
There is a literal chair. Yeah. I did not know that.
Yes.
Patrick Schreiner is in an endowed chair. Uh-huh. And he showed me his chair in his office. And then Dr. Whitney, he was telling me, because you kept to pick out what kind of chair you want.
Good.
There's like options. He told me to get the rocking chair. So I don't know if Dr. Whitney like sits in his endowed rocking chair.
I mean, if you have an endowed chair that's a rocking chair, you should probably sit in it just to, soak it all in.
Just to bask
Yes,
in
just
the,
soak
in
it
the
in.
Endowed chair
yes,
position.
Come on.
Well, there's no transition.
Yeah,
to
I was
make.
Wondering how you're gonna pull this one off, like rocking chair to
well,
deconstruction.
Well, rocking like being tossed to and fro.
Oh,
perhaps.
Wow. Okay, there's something
Ephesians
there.
Ephesians 4 by every window yeah. doctrine. We're talking about ministry in the deconstruction
yeah.
era. You know, deconstruction, is that still a thing? Do you think like,
yes.
what is the deconstruction phenomenon from your perspective?
Yeah, so I do think, and maybe listeners would disagree with this, I do think the deconstruction era was a little bit unique to my generation.
Okay, which is millennials.
Yeah, I'm like right smack dab in the middle of the millennial generation, leaning towards the older side. But, it's not that I don't think Gen X, you know, had deconstruction problems. Boomers probably obviously had their own issues, and Gen Z, Gen Alpha, they're all going to deal with it in some way. But it does feel like the millennials raised primarily by boomers. The boomers brought with them a cultural form of Christianity
yeah.
that millennials have just not accepted. And it came large part in the shift of America being going from like, it's just assumed culturally that you're a Christian, to now actually that's kind of a net negative on your social cachet or your social yeah. you know equity, as it were. And so there is a in the millennial generation, there is a serious, I mean, if you walk through one of the ways that we see it the most, where it's like, oh man, it's kind of sad, is in my own friend group who graduated, you know, from college with me, the amount of my friends that have biblical studies bachelor's degrees mm-hmm. who are not in ministry and not even believing anymore is pretty astounding. And then a place that me and my wife notice it is when we listen to Christian music, where it's like, oh, that guy doesn't believe that anymore.
Oh yeah.
We'll listen to a song and be like, those are amazing lyrics. That guy doesn't believe anymore. And so it's a really serious phenomenon. I do think it is uniquely millennial. So to your question, is it still happening? I do think Gen Z will have the residue, the fallout from the deconstruction era. But I do think it's waning. I actually think there's in my generation, when I was in college, I tell my students that when I was in school, it felt like doubt was a currency, and doubt was the fastest way to credit. Like the more confident you were in your doctrine, the less authentic it was. And the more you like kind of did that posture, you know, the doubting hands up, shoulder shrug posture, the more real your faith was. Like, I don't know, this could be true, I'm not really sure.
Right.
So doubt was kind of a commodity. And so, yeah, so I, you know, just, you know, transparent to the listeners, sometimes Jared will think of episodes, sometimes I'll think of episode idea. This is one I submitted that I wanted to talk about, just because in my own context, the things that I tend to like in life tend to put me around those who are deconstructing or trying to reconstruct, or most often who have already deconstructed, like they're done with the process. So, you know, I love, you know, hipster third wave coffee. I love, you know, I grew up on like punk music and skateboarding. And so just the subcultures that I find myself in, even now, like I love like indie singer-songwriter music, and just those subcultures often have those who are deconstructing or have already done that process. And so this subject is just a little bit of a touchy one for me, in the sense of, I know a lot of people who are in the process, who have completed the process, or who have turned the process around by the grace of God. I know men and women who were very close to just kind of leaving it all behind, who now their faith is very solid. They're stable. They love the local church. They love the gospel. They love Christ. They're cherishing him again. Their affections for him are on fire. And so just like seeing what it looks like for a brother or sister to get close to the brink and then say, no, I'm coming home.
Yeah.
It's just worth it to think about this and to press into those kinds of friends.
Yeah, it's one of my hopes and prayers as well, as you see, because I do think the trend is waning. Mm-hmm. And I think what happened in particular in sort of the millennial experience, like generationally, is there's something that every generation of Christians kind of goes through. In there, especially if you're raised in the church, I think it's different if you weren't, probably. I mean, maybe years later you kind of look back and go, ah, do I really believe or something? But I think it's usually a generation that's raised in church. And every generation that's raised in church, goes through in their young adult years a kind of evaluation of like, yeah. do I really believe this or do I just believe this because my parents do or mm-hmm. because my church told me it's true? Like, do I actually believe this? And so there is a kind of evaluative. I mean, I went through not, you know, I wasn't deconstructing or evaluating, you know, the claims of orthodoxy, really. I mean, I can't even remember a time where I doubted that God was real or yeah. that Christ was real or that he was crucified and resurrected. I didn't have doubts like that. But I did kind of the cultural baggage
yes.
or the cultural packaging,
yeah.
some of those like secondary and tertiary views, I kind of worked through, like, what do I believe about baptism? Am I just, if I'm getting interested in Reformed theology, does that mean I should be a paedo-baptist? Like, mm-hmm. it seems like all the guys I'm reading, you know, all the old ed guys that I really enjoy, they're all paedo-baptists. Maybe I should, yeah. you know. So, I sorted through that, the, you know, Reformed theology, eschatology. And I do think that there is, for some young adults, especially they leave home or they go to college and they're exposed to new ideas. And maybe for the first time, they're outside of kind of a cloister or protected, you know, ideological protection. And they're hearing different ideas and they have to sort through, do I really believe this?
Yes.
What happened for the millennials, I think, is that experience happened at the same time as the critical race theory stuff yeah. and the social justice conversation. And so there was a whole cultural piece, the Me Too mm-hmm. movement, all of those things kind of created this perfect storm of resistance, almost animosity or hostility towards the establishment or thing, mm-hmm. right? And so standpoint epistemology and just all these things just coalesced with what could have been a normal or just the, you know, a generational, a recurring generational thing. And it turned deconstruction into, I think, a phenomenon. Stronger force and a bigger phenomenon
yeah.
than it normally would be. It
yeah.
became a cultural force. That's rather right. than just sort of a generational
one
milestone.
One of the things I'm seeing, too, to show that I think you're exactly right, is it has very little to do with intellectual belief, honestly. I am around people who are in that process all the time. And it's almost never like, oh, yeah, I'm doubting the resurrection. That's just not the conversation that's happening.
Yeah.
And I'm saying that as like a, you know, a systematic theologian who loves to think about those things. But it's almost never like I have this intellectual doubt. It's almost more of like a moral repugnancy.
Yeah.
Like, it is not you're stupid for believing X, which is kind of what old apologetics used to be. It is now you're bad for believing Y.
Right.
You know, about whether it's about sexuality or gender yes. or what have you. Those are much stronger. And we are in such an identity politics era where it's like, it's no longer just like individual beliefs. It's like, who's my tribe? And it's definitely not going to be you guys. And so maybe my tribe's actually a little more over here.
Right.
And
I mean, gender and sexuality is where this is really playing out. So that the deconstruction is about, in terms of evangelicalism, Christianity, is largely focused on either what they perceive as complementarian mm-hmm. institutional or patriarchal mm-hmm. institution, or hetero, you know, quote unquote heteronormative mm-hmm. institutional, those sorts of things. So if you've thrown in with kind of the new gender revolution, you know, transgenderism and homosexuality and everything else, it's almost like you said, again, it's not about a full frontal assault on the, you know, the virgin birth and the resurrection and the, you know, Trinity or
that's
anything
right.
like that.
That's
it's
right.
about these cultural transgressions that they're saying evangelicalism was prohibitive and in imposed a morality that was coercive
that's
or
right.
harmful or, or abusive,
yeah.
like
yes.
even just the abuse conversation
yeah.
where abuse becomes pushed into every corner of the room. Everything is abuse now. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, the byproduct of that is I think, an erosion in the historical truth claims of Christianity because the focus is taken off of them.
Mm-hmm.
And you throw in with a tribe that doesn't center those. So even if that's not the main concern or the main issue or the main argument, it becomes a byproduct.
Yes.
You bring in heresy sort of through the side door
mm-hmm.
when you adopt these sort of cultural, cultural trappings, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. I'd love to, unless you have something else you want to talk about there, I'd love to turn the conversation to kind of ministering.
Yeah, I mean, the topic is ministry
in this era. Yeah.
So how does ministry change?
That's a good kind of contextual framework for what's going on, and then now ministering to this. I don't think it's going to be forever, so I think this is maybe a unique season of ministry right now. I hope Gen Z doesn't have this same phenomenon like we've discussed. I think Gen Alpha, you know, be similarly. In fact, I could actually foresee a world in which Gen Alpha rebels against their millennial parents towards institutional religion.
Well, I think we're already seeing this with some of the younger Gen Z in particular, and I assume with Gen Alpha, which is the youngest, they're coming up after Gen Z. You're already seeing a resurgence of religious interest among young adults. You see, I also kind of a resurgent interest in almost social conservatism and things like that.
Yeah.
Maybe it's not always religious, or Christian, or even specifically Christian, but there is a conservatism almost like a pendulum swing back.
It's like
from
a little bit of a rebellion.
We see what's like the moral chaos or just the chaotic life,
the subjectiveness.
Of this. I mean, there's all kind like drinking is down.
That's wild.
Premarital sex is down. I mean, even like lifestyle licentiousness is in decline.
Yeah. So back to the beauty. I do think that's, you know, again, it's seasonal, but just from my own experience, I don't want to say these things as like, hey, I think every pastor needs to pick up these tools and use them. This is just Ronnie talking from Ronnie's experience about being around those who are deconstructing and just being in those subcultures. I would say the first thing I want to say here is I think this is where beauty has a unique apologetical value, where I think historically apologetics have focused on truth claims, which is good and right. We do want to talk about the historical truth of the Christian faith of orthodoxy. But I think truth claims will only go so far. You need to be able to not only identify why something is true, but why something is beautiful. And I think beauty has a gravitational pull to my generation that does feel a little unique. And so, I mean, it's a silly example, but I was arguing, not arguing, that's not even the right word. I was discussing the necessity of church membership with a dear friend of mine who's just kind of been hurt by the church and is probably not interested in like giving himself to the church in terms of like a membership capacity.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think historically I would have gone to like biblical passages to be like, look, it's obviously biblical. But I remember just in this conversation with this brother, like, I'm not sure that that's going to be the persuasive thing. And so I actually used a fictional scene from The Brothers Karamazov that was actually about, it's a scene I've talked about on this podcast before, but Ivan and Alyosha talking about how easy it is to love the idea of mankind, but not actual men. And I used it to say, like, you care about love, and there's a beauty in your desire to love your neighbor. And even if it's not like, you know, the exact way Jesus would think about loving your neighbor, you have the desire to love your neighbor. And I think church membership actually identifies for you who those neighbors are. And church membership actually forces you to love real people, not the idea of people. And I use the, you know, at Emmaus, at the church I'm a member of, we take communion every week. And so every Sunday, there's like this parade of saints that it's like, that's the one I'm responsible for. That's the one I'm responsible for. That's the one I'm responsible for. And I can't love the idea of men or women. I have to love those men and women. And there was like a real attractiveness to him, for him, in that model of like, oh, there is a beauty here that is unique. And so obviously I could do the biblical like, hey, there's these one another's and it says submit to your elders, which ones? And you know, I could make the biblical case, but there was a unique draw to the beauty of the thing. And so I do think that is huge. I think along with beauty, there is a real pull towards humanness in a lot of my deconstructing friends that is really helpful from a Christian perspective of having an in. I think a lot of my friends who are deconstructing or in that process are looking around at the church and saying, like, I don't love that. But then they're looking at, like, the tech world and all of the tech bros who are, like, trying to become, you know, robots themselves. And, like, I also don't love that. And taking them back to, like, something ancient, something creaturely, something human, I do think has a uniquely persuasive value right now of, hey, actually, what if... what if I told you that pressing into your creatureliness is actually a Christian thing to do, you know?
Yeah.
And I have found C.S. Lewis's Space Trilogy to be like wildly helpful with my deconstructing friends. Even just like the whole, specifically that Hideous Strength and the worldview of the NICE, the worldview of Ransom and his friends, and just trying to show them, you actually, you're one of these.
Yeah.
You know, you're with Ransom and the crew. And that has some persuasive value. So one last thing, and then I'm talking a lot. I'll turn it over to you. I also would encourage brothers who are ministering, brothers and sisters who are ministering in a deconstruction era, to make sure the individual feels heard. That's really significant. And make sure that you're attuned to what is being said, and is there anything behind what's being said? Because what I don't want people to do is like psychoanalyze everything. Everyone who's deconstructing, I don't want them to be psychoanalyzed. However, my experience does say there is often church hurt here. Mm-hmm. And they might be saying this moral thing or this intellectual thing, but really they've been hurt, they've been abandoned, they've been like not seen, they've been not heard by someone in the church. And that's the impetus for a lot of this. And so just validating some of those. I mean, yeah. I don't want you to like, there's like this over therapy culture where you have to validate everything. You don't have to do that, but making them feel seen and heard and validated is helpful.
Yeah. I have in my notes just the kind of, I wrote down victimhood mentality, which is, I think a departure danger from the gospel. I actually wrote about in my book, Lest We Drift, where yes, the church hurt or the sort of perception of harmful structures or harmful even teaching. That's the thing when we're talking about a abusive environment, because there's no question that the, you know, evangelicalism has had an abuse problem. There are mm-hmm. abusive pastors. There are churches that have protected abusive, abusers in the church, or yes. just an abusive climate in the church. So that perception, even if exaggerated, is based on,
yes,
you know, on true things that are happening. But what happens is that gets translated into Christianity itself, right? Mm-hmm. So some will say it's clearly complementarianism is abusive because of all these complementarians who, you know, have abused people. They make a connection. And so what happens is they begin to paint themselves as kind of, you know, perpetual victims. And that sells really well, at least yes. or it has.
Yeah.
I don't know if it will continue to, but that is something that has become a cottage industry unto itself. Yeah. And so there are people who will sell you deconstruction ideas and the ideology and the tribal because they're appealing to a sense of victimhood. Mm-hmm. Someone has been hurt. Hey, we share your hurt. Come with us, yes. right? For $20 a month, you two can join our, you know. Yeah. It's like, well, okay. But there are some things, I think, just some things that I would add in terms of preaching and teaching in particular, to know that you have, if you've got this, you know, generational presence in your church. Number one, narrative is really big.
Yes, that's
so
true.
So, like,
yes.
I think one of the appeals of the deconstructors out of the church and into these other kind of trends or movements or tribes is that there's a story that they are telling that they see themselves in, whether it's this church hurt issue or just some kind of injustice issue. I'm a woman and now I'm perceiving that there is some oppressiveness towards women in this culture, and they're telling a story about the history of yeah. of oppression of women and where we're going. There's almost an eschatological thing. We're pursuing justice or freedom or something. We're going to get to the golden age somehow if we press against this injustice. And so there's a story that they find themselves in. And so I think for preaching and teaching to not just have the propositional data of Christianity, you have to have that, but to put that in the narrative of the gospel,
That's just great. Be
rehearsing the gospel storyline over and over again.
That's great.
This place is broken because of what happened in that garden. Mm-hmm. And the story of the Bible is a cohesive story. And the things that are happening in our world generationally, right, are not foreign to that narrative. So to be rehearsing the narrative of the gospel, that people can see themselves in a story or find their place in a story, to see the plot points of that story. I do think also for preachers to be mindful of How they're, I mean, this is just good, I think, evangelistic kind of or missional thinking to explain terms, to have a kind of not, obviously we all believe this kind of mentality when preaching. You have you have folks, if they've not deconstructed, you have young people, you have skeptics who will be present, and they want you not to talk to them as if they're already convinced. Have a kind of apologetic position in your preaching. Now, you know, the Sunday morning service is not a seeker service. It's not to be centered on lost people. It is a gathering of the body of Christ. And yet, to be mindful of outsiders who are there, can you explain terms? You know, try to minimize the amount of churchy lingo that you use. I'm constantly mindful that while our Sunday morning gathering is for Liberty Baptist Church members, I'm just aware of how many guests and visitors and unbelieving family and friends that our people are bringing. They're very evangelistic people, and that includes bringing lost people to church every Sunday.
Yeah.
And so it's part of that kind of juggling. I know it can be hard to do this sometimes, but I want to make sure, like, from the very beginning, when I say turn to this passage, like, I know there are people in the room, like, maybe it's the first time they've opened up a Bible, or they don't, you know, they don't know where 2 Corinthians is. So I'm going to tell them, right, this is where you find that book in your Bible. And we have chair Bibles. This is on page whatever of your chair Bible. So even from the outset, I'm just trying to be mindful of those who are sorting through things, whether they've been churched and now they're kind of deconstructing, or they're kind of new and they're kind of figuring things out. I want to be, holding hands in some way, hospitable in some way, winsome in some way. I want to be anticipating those little objections that pop up, especially if there are cultural narratives that are in opposition to, Jonathan Dodson. I don't know if this is original to Dodson, but he has a phrase he calls gospel defeaters. Like, what are the things that pop up in people's heads that are arguments against the gospel, you know, story that you're telling? Or an objection that they've got, an argument they've got. Can you anticipate that ahead of time?
Yeah.
Not just let somebody sit in it, but can you anticipate it and then bring it up as you're doing your exposition? You know, address that almost preemptively for people. I think explaining, but also not apologizing. I think
that's right.
The overcorrection for pastors is to, like, always feel like you're on your heels or
being embarrassed
about the truth claims of Scripture, or apologizing for them, or like, I know this sounds like, no, like, God put that in His Word.
Yeah.
You don't need to be a bull in a china shop about it, but I think you can confidently preach I know you can confidently preach God's Word and not feel like you've got to apologize for it or have some kind of, you know, secondhand embarrassment about it. And like you, Ronnie, I'm hoping and praying that this is more of a seasonal thing. I do sense that there are even folks, if this is kind of a weird iteration of the dropout rate, which has been pretty consistent over the last several generations, like almost 70%, I think, of young adults who are raised in the church, they kind of pull away or they drop out. Stats show that a good number of them, I don't know the percentages, but come back.
Yep.
There's something about growing up, outgrowing, the narrative gets old, the social media cycles actually have a pretty short shelf life.
Yep.
It may feel like everything to a young person who's spending their life online in particular, but maturity, entering the real world, having their own sense of, like, experimentation with this thing that doesn't actually work.
Yeah, that's right.
You know? I think we may be,
and there's
seeing people deconstruct their deconstruction.
That's exactly right. You know? Amen. Maybe. Yeah, there's also, we've been in it long enough that there's been good resources put out. I mean, Ian Harbor has done good work. He has a book called Walking Through Deconstruction, which is on this exact topic. It's not really for the deconstructor themselves. It's for a person walking with someone through it. I think of, like, Trevin Wax, you know, his Thrill of Orthodoxy was a really helpful book to show, hey, if you're looking for adventure, the adventure is actually not on the fringes.
Yeah, yeah.
It's actually in the center. That's where the real thrill is, the center of orthodoxy. And even, you know, he did a podcast of, you know, Reconstructing Faith. It was a very helpful podcast he did. So there's been there's just two names that come to mind off the top of my head, but there's been a number of folks who have put out good resources on this topic.
Yes. Yeah.
It's become more of a thing.
Yeah. There's a little book with TGC and I contributed to it, but I can't remember the title. But it's actually written for
deconstructors. Yes, like it's something like Before You Lose Your Faith or something like that. Yeah. And it's every chapter is almost like a consider this or think about this.
Yeah,
and
that's good.
That was a few years ago. It might be worth checking out. Anything else to say before we move? Okay, let me just read from Ephesians chapter 4, verses 14 and 15. Then we will no longer be little children, tossed by the waves and blown around by every wind of teaching, by human cunning with cleverness in the techniques of deceit. But speaking the truth in love, let us grow in every way into Him who is the head, Christ. Speaking the truth in love, I think, is the main takeaway there. If you enjoy the podcast, dear listener, please give us a good review. Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, wherever you listen to or watch your favorite podcasts. As always, you can send questions for the mailbag or just comments, reviews to mailbag@ftc.co, mailbag@ftc.co. And until next time, may Jesus be big in your church.